It is good to be in church this morning and good to see each of you here. It is Heritage Sunday. I guess we've kind of struggled with exactly what to call this Sunday. Cowboy Sunday. Someone called it Chuck Wagon Sunday. I'm just going to kind of go with it, but my sermon is going to be about our heritage as Americans and as Christians. And I want us to look at that in a serious light this morning. I want to spend a little bit of time thinking about that, and I won't keep you too long. I know we have brisket and pulled pork and a lot of sides, and I know the smell of that is kind of emanating in the room. And people don't want to hear me drone on and on too long with good food in the waiting. So I will endeavor not to do that. But I do want us to cover a little bit of ground this morning. There are some important things that we need to bring to mind and to think about this morning. Our scripture is from the book of 2 Timothy, chapter 1, verses 3 through 5. I thank God, whom I serve from my forefathers with pure conscience, that without ceasing I have remembrance of thee in my prayers night and day, greatly desiring to see thee, being mindful of thy tears, that I may be filled with joy. When I call to remembrance the unfeigned faith that is in thee, which dwelt first in thy grandmother Lois and thy mother Eunice, and I am persuaded that it is in thee also. May God add to the reading of his scripture. Recorded history is often wrong. What we read in the newspapers, what we see on television, what becomes history is often either completely wrong or it misses the larger context or the larger story that is going on. And I want us to try and understand our heritage from that perspective. What we see often, or what we think of often when we talk about American heritage, and especially that of Western America, Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, New Mexico, all across our country, and particularly this part, is we think about cowboys, right? We think about six guns and shootouts and the OK Corral and Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp and all of those people. That is such a small, small part of our history that it's almost not even worth mentioning. Do you know the shootout at the OK Corral lasted 30 seconds? Yet Hollywood has made 10 movies about it, and there have been countless books about it. That was such a small event in such a small piece of this country that it's almost not even worth mentioning. We need to look at what is the real American true history, and it is not quite as flamboyant. The truth is that the American history, our history, is that of common people who lived ordinary lives and who were of service to God and to each other. So to understand this history, we have to kind of back up long way, really. 1720s to 1740s was the Great Awakening. In New England, there were a lot of people who had come to the country and had started settling. There were the small settlements there along the East Coast. And there arose a revival movement with people like George Whitefield and Jonathan Edwards, who started preaching the plain, simple gospel of Jesus Christ, and they did so in fields because there were no buildings large enough to hold the crowds of people that came out. They preached a very simple gospel: repent of your sin or face the consequences. Jonathan Edwards preached his famous sermon, A Sinner in the Hands of an Angry God, which in my opinion ought to be required reading in every school in the country. And sadly enough, it is not. In that sermon, he likened people, lost people, to a spider hanging on a single thread over a great pit of fire held only by the hand of God, who at any moment could hurl them headlong into eternal damnation. Got people's attention. It created such a fervor, such a stir. People wanted to get their lives right, and it created that, along with several others, created a revival movement. Then past that, there was a second great awakening. This occurred early in the 19th century and lasted a bit longer. And the second revival meeting, or the second great awakening as it's often called, was a bit different. People had spread out from New England and from the East Coast out in the countryside into Kentucky and Tennessee and all the way down to Georgia, and were beginning to march across the United States and settle it. These people were not big farmers. They weren't big plantation owners. Typically, it would be a mom and dad and their children, and they would move west and they would homestead a piece of property and start farming it. We think about, and sometimes we see, and I understand they're very good stories. We see the stories of the giant cattle ranches, the XIT up by Dalhart or King Ranch, or a variety of other of the really huge cattle ranches. 99.9% of cattle were raised by mom and dad on a 40-acre piece of property. It wasn't these giant ranches that we hear about. And literally, the cattle drives lasted no more than about 30 years. We love to romanticize about the cowboy riding across the open plain on his horse with his rifle, and everything is just picture perfect. And I'll be honest with you, I'd love to do that. Sometimes I think, wow, I wonder what this country looked like back before there were roads and fences and houses and people everywhere. We recently had the privilege of going on a driving vacation all the way up through Kansas, Nebraska, Montana, and then back down to New Mexico and back home. And I thought continually while driving through that, I can imagine in my mind what this country looked like when there were millions of buffalo roaming the plains, when it was just man or on a horse with a gun. But that's not really the way the West was settled. The West was settled with families starting small farms, typically of 40 acres and sometimes even less. Because to be honest, a 40-acre piece of park property, if all you have is a mule and a plow, is a tremendous amount of ground to try and cultivate and clear and raise something on. You can't do 1,000 acres or several thousand like farmers do today, because they didn't have big tractors. They didn't have all of those things. So that was kind of the settlements. And when this second great revival started, it was preachers that spread out to these rural communities, and they started preaching revivals, Brush Arbor revivals specifically, in these little bitty remote communities. And people would come. They would gather from miles around. They called them sometimes camp meetings, and they would last for a week or maybe more. And it created a spirit of revival, and a lot of people got their life straight with God and went home and built churches or joined churches. Every little community had at least three churches. Where I grew up, and I grew up in a place, though I grew up in the 60s and 70s, it was in rural western Arkansas, Yell County, and it was about 50 years behind most of the rest of the world. The little valley was 20 miles long, had five towns and 18 churches. And that is kind of what was all over the United States at one time. Little towns that were a couple of hundred people, and they would have three churches, usually maybe four. There would be a Baptist, a Methodist. There would be some type of assembly or Pentecostal church. There may be a Church of Christ, maybe Presbyterian or Lutheran. Those were what made up the community, and everyone belonged to one of those churches. We have a nice group of people here this morning, and though we have about as many traveling, I think, as we have here, it's good to see what we do have. Where I grew up, our church ran around 40 people, but we only had 200 in the whole town. So if you think 40 people out of 200, that's a lot of folks, right? And down the street at the Baptist church, there were that many there, and over at the assembly there were that many, etc. And the next thing you know, everyone is affiliated in some way with a church. Now we're in cities and we get 40, 50 people out. Some of the mega churches I know get a lot more, but it's still a small percentage compared to the population. America began and grew with small communities and small churches. As a part of this great awakening, both one and two came to be what is referred to as the Protestant or sometimes Puritan work ethic. You've probably heard of that, the Protestant work ethic. What does that mean? It was built on three pillars. And this is, I think, if we look at our country today and we see where we've been, where we're at, and where we're going, this is one of the most important things to understand. The Protestant work ethic said the following. One, be obedient to God. Go to church, live right, be a moral person, do what's right, do the right thing in the eyes of God. Two, be devoted to your family. Above everything except God, be devoted to your family. And three, work hard every day of your life. If you will do those things, you'll be prosperous. And you know what? It worked. People in these rural communities really believed that and really practiced it, and as a result, they really were prosperous people. It kind of makes sense. If we go out and we live an immoral life and we have 10 different spouses or partners and we never settle down with any one of them, and we live our life devoted only to ourselves, and we try to work as little as we can, you'll end up broke and alone. That's just a reality, right? But if you follow this kind of Protestant work ethic where you really are committed to the teaching of God and to the church, and you really are committed to your family, and you really do work hard every day, not only will you be successful, but you will see generational success. You know, one of the things that we have to do when we're thinking about family, if we can get everybody going in the same direction, especially family. I know that's a hard thing to do, isn't it? In church, if we can get everybody going in the same direction and pulling in the same direction, we can accomplish great things. Sometimes, as a pastor, you get the feeling that it's kind of like herding chickens. They go a lot of different directions, right? And you get calls in the middle of the week that say, oh, I need to do this, I need to do that, or something else. And you get the feeling, gosh, that's a little counterproductive to what we're trying to do. The same thing is true in the family. Anyone who has been part of a large family knows that you will always have those people in the family that seem to be trying to go in the wrong direction, that seem to be wanting to take off on their own. But mom and dad and children, if you'll work together, if you can share this kind of Protestant work ethic, if you can all come together and say, this is what we want to do as a family. Not only will you be successful, but you will see your family be successful as time goes by. Small communities had some characteristics. I love the small community, and if I could, I would probably live in Bluffton, Arkansas today. But the truth is, I could be an accountant there, but there's nobody to work with because they've all left, right? You have to have people. Small communities, though, had some things that I do miss to a certain extent. I remember, and I guess this will be kind of my time to get emotional maybe. I remember as a young man, people had chairs in their front yard. Either you would have chairs on your front porch, or very often you'd have a group of trees out in the front yard, and there would be lawn chairs under those trees. And in the evenings, people came and sat down and visited with each other. Neighbors would literally stop by your house, or you might go by theirs, and you would just sit down and talk about whatever is going on in your life. We didn't have air conditioning. Well, we did actually, but it was just in one room. And Mom and Dad would only let us turn it on if the preacher or somebody like that was coming. So most of the time, it was off. And it was hot. And so in the summertime, you sat out there under those trees. And people would stop by, and you would visit. When someone in the community was sick, everybody else in the community pitched in and tried to help. And would take food or would visit. It was considered your duty to do that. And one of the things about our church that I love so much is that when someone is having an issue of any kind, other people kick in and try to help. And I have seen it over and over, genuine, honest concern for the other church members. I love that sense of community. I remember one time, this came along as I was a small boy and ended as I was a small boy, so I was only involved in one time. Our neighbor, Mr. Rufus Benefield, an elderly man, everybody knew he was reaching the end of his life and he was sick. When Rufus passed away, the first of all, they didn't take him to a funeral home or whatever, he was at home. The men of the church went to the cemetery, and we opened the grave. We dug the grave. There were no backhoes in that part of the world at that time, so people just came out, showed up, dug the grave, and then after the funeral service was over, the men of the church stayed around, and we covered the grave, let him down in the grave and covered it up. And that seemed like such a small thing, but really it wasn't. It was community. From the time a child was born in that community, he belonged to the entire community. I had 100 mothers. I could do nothing wrong without my mother. The party lines would get hot. Did you know? I saw your son. Yeah. I had 100 mothers out there and fathers. The community was that way. And if someone got sick, we all surrounded them. And when someone died, we all went to the grave with them, even to the point of opening and closing the grave. That was a different time. That's part of our heritage. We had little stores. Some of y'all may have grown up or lived in similar communities where you had a little store. Our little store, Bluffton, had one called Doris Store, Doris Ferguson's Gas and Grocery. There was another one in Gravely, the other little town on the other side of us. Dora was a little woman that was about as big around as she was tall. Her husband had died several years ago, and she ran that store sitting on a nail keg. And she kept everything written down on a notebook. And she knew everyone and everything and everything that was going on in that community. If you needed to know, she knew. Guarantee you she knew. Well, in about 1965, I was 7, 8 years old. Dad was sick. He had cancer and was really bad shape. We were going to the VA hospital in Little Rock to treat him. And we grew chickens, nearly 30,000 of them, and we had cows. And so our income came when we sold them. And typically we did quite well, but occasionally times would get tight. So we were taking Dad to the doctor or to the hospital, and Mother had gone around the house and gathered up some change. And gasoline back then was about 25 cents a gallon, so it didn't take a lot of change. She was going to put, I don't remember the amount, $4 or $5 in change in gasoline for us to get to the Little Rock to the hospital and back. We stopped up at Ferguson's, and Mother said, "You go in and give Miss Ferguson this change and tell her this is how much gas we're pumping, and I'll pump the gas." Well, I went in and did as I was told, gave it to her. And this little woman got up very mad. She said, "No, you will not." Scared me to death. Marched me outside and she said to my mother, "You'll fill your tank up and we'll write it down. You'll buy whatever groceries you need and we'll write it down. What kind of person would I be if I let you go in need?" Try that at Walmart today. Doesn't happen, does it? That was small communities. The people were real and they genuinely cared for each other. That's our real heritage. It's not shootouts in the middle of the night. It's not giant cattle drives. It's real people in real communities that honestly cared for each other. That's where we came from. So, where are we now? Well, we've all moved to town, and we've become much more technological. Although we live in crowded cities, one of the big surprises, I have to stop here, for me coming to Texas. I had heard all of my life about the big spaces and how much room there was. Where I grew up, if I left my front yard, I could ride my horse 25 miles without coming to a fence or a highway. When I got to Texas, if I got off of my 1 acre lawn, I was on somebody else's property and they weren't happy about it. Didn't really seem like the big open spaces I'd always heard about, right? Today, we live in crowded cities. We have lots of technology. If you take this cell phone and look at it, there is more information right here than people that I grew up with got in their entire lifetimes. Yet with all of that, we are more and more isolated, and people feel more and more alone than they ever have. I think it's because of a couple of things. We have lost the small community atmosphere. We have lost a lot of that. And that's one of the things that Family of Faith Church is built on and dedicated to doing, is trying to bring back that small community understanding and compassion. And two, we've lost the Protestant work ethic. Somewhere around 1965, came the Great Society legislation. And if you look at that, we declared a war on poverty. And we said, you don't have to look to mom and dad or your husband or your wife to provide. The government will give you a safety net and we'll provide for you. Children no longer had to depend on their parents. Now then, the government will feed them. No longer did men and women have to stay married to survive. The government will step in and take care of you. And as a result, the fabric of our society is coming apart. It's beginning to fray. It is not uncommon today to meet people and them have four or five different kids from four or five different spouses, and honestly, I'm not trying to put anyone down. But back in the day, people depended on each other. And when you got married, it was a serious thing. That Protestant work ethic that said, be dedicated to your family. When Becky and I got married, I remember very well standing there before practically everybody we knew and God Himself, and I made a vow that I would forsake all others and would cleave only to her. And that was a promise. And that didn't change. Our society has said, it's okay, it doesn't matter. I had a young lady in the office that I worked in who was about to get married. Had five other women in the office, and I heard them in there one day, and they said, now we need to give you some advice. I thought, oh, Lord. They started out, when you get divorced. Not if, not what happens if they... When you get divorced, you need to do this, this, and this. And I said, you know, we shouldn't plan from that from the get-go. This ought to be something that we don't plan to end. You, parents, should provide for your children and no one else. That's important. You, as mom and dad, ought to fix them breakfast, lunch, and supper. That's important. Your children ought to be accountable to you and no one else. That's important. Because that creates this fabric that is our society. Hard work. There is a redeeming quality in work. I believe in work. Too often today, we don't. I don't know if you watch such things. In the news I saw yesterday, the labor participation rate in the United States is somewhere around 60% now. It means 40% of the people in the country just flat don't work at anything. We ought to all work. Disabled, able, whatever, we ought to all be doing something. If you're not working at a job to provide a living for your family, then find something useful that you as a person can do. And I know this is not a popular thing to say, even from the pulpit, but it's true. One of the people that I loved and admired so much, a man in Sherman named Morris Davis. Morris turned 65, his wife had passed away, and he retired. He told me, he sat around my house for about a week and said I was going to go crazy. I thought, I've got to do something. So he went and volunteered with Meals on Wheels and started delivering food. He did so till he was almost 100 years old. In fact, it got to where they would say, Morris, you can do this, but somebody else has to drive. You're too old to be driving around delivering them. And I think in some ways maybe God let him live so long and be healthy all the time because he served other people. He didn't just sit down and quit. We need to work, all of us. I've often said I'll probably die at work, and it's true. But I'll die there not because I want to, but probably because I can't afford to go home. So where are we going? There is some questions that we still have to ask. Does family still matter? Yes, family matters. Does community matter? Yes, community matters. We are a community. We live in this community and we know each other. We worship together. We are church together. And it matters. And I believe that God will bless us as a community. All right, now I will quit. If our musicians will come.